From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American student debt has now exceeded $1 trillion. It's a terrible burden for a lot of young graduates starting life. And it's a threat, says Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, like the housing crisis before it, to the whole U.S. economy and its fairness. Stiglitz argues for a fundamental rethinking of how we pay for higher education. This hour on Point, Joseph Stiglitz on America's student debt crisis. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is that you carrying the student loan burden? What's the impact on your life, on the country? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in the hour, a commencement address from British singer-songwriter Annie Lennox. And we'll go in a moment to Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. But first, federal interest rates on student loan debt are about to double to 6.8% unless Congress acts. Tamar Lewin is higher education reporter for the New York Times. She's been following all the proposals out there to avert that spike. Tamar, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
When does it go up and why that much if nothing is done?
Well, it goes up July 1st, and this happened exactly the same way last year. It was scheduled to go up last July 1st.
Yep.
And it had only actually been down at this relatively low 3.4% for 1 year. It was always scheduled to go back up. And then the economy being what it is and the really emerging sense that student debt is a big, big, big problem. Last year they did a last-minute save, and I imagine they will this year, but there's all kinds of proposals out there to stop it from being something that Congress has to deal with every year and find some long-term fix.
I mean, it was high, and then people looked around and said, wait a minute, year after year, we've got these super low interest rates, and yet it's still high, so they brought it down, but with an automatic bounce back up now again, if nothing is done. What's the range of proposals out there, Tamar?
Oh, we got quite a lot. We have Elizabeth Warren, who says, well, why should students pay more than big banks do? I think we should set it at 0.75%, which is what the big banks pay, for 1 year. This got a whole lot of traction, as you could imagine, and she got more than 300,000 signatures on her petition kind of right away.
Yeah, let's do that, everybody who's borrowing says.
I don't think that has much chance of passing. And there's two or three issues that remain to be resolved. Most people do think we will go to some market-based rate that will be tied to the government's cost of borrowing. But that the devil's in the details, as always, and that doesn't mean we're anywhere near real agreement. There's some people, including Senator Harkin, who's the head of the Senate committee that deals with this, who say, let's take some time. Let's do this as part of the higher ed reauthorization. Let's do a – we'll stick to 3.4% for 2 years while we consider this thoughtfully. But today, the House is marking up the Republican bill that would tie it to 10-year Treasury notes, and it would set the rates for all Stafford loans, which are both the subsidized and unsubsidized, at 2.5% more than the Stafford loans, and it would cap it at 8.5%. But it would reset every year, so as interest rates go back up, which eventually they will,
sure,
people will take out loans and find that as they go, they get really more expensive. And the House Democrats have just come out with numbers from the Congressional Research Service that say, wait, this is just a terrible deal. And while it might sound okay, the Congressional Research Service says everybody will end up paying over 5 years way more interest, even if it sounds reasonable to start with, way more interest under that bill over 5 years than even if the rate doubles back to 6.8%. Meanwhile, the Republicans criticized the Obama proposal, which was also tied to the Treasury rates and had no cap. And they say, wait, no cap? That means people are in terrible danger, you know, again, as rates go up. But that one, the rate would be fixed right at the beginning for the life of the loan. So there's kind of danger on every side. There's some proposals to tie it not to the 10-year Treasury, but to the 3-month treasury. Yeah. There's let's keep it down for 1 year. There's a lot
lots of ways to go. Tamar, I want to hear a couple of the voices attached to this. You mentioned President Obama. He's been talking about this. Of course, he did last year at the same sort of point, coming up on a big spike. This was the president at North Carolina, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, last April.
There's one specific thing that Congress needs to do right now to prevent the interest rates on student loans, federal student loans, from shooting up and shaking you down.
Shaking you down. The federal government, I'm reading here, Tamar, made $50 billion in, you know, quote unquote, profit on those loans last year. And then here's Elizabeth Warren, freshman senator out of Massachusetts, introduced the Bank on Students Loan Fairness Act this month that would charge students, as you say, the same interest rate as the federal government charges big banks, 0.75% on student loans.
We shouldn't be profiting from our students who are drowning in debt while we're giving a great deal to the big banks. We should be investing in our young people so they can get good jobs and grow the economy. So let's give them the same great deal that the banks get.
Of course, she would only do it for 1 year. Tamar, why is anybody making money on these loans? I mean, after all, they're to go to school. Why would the federal government want any kind of return on them?
Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, someone has to. A lot of these go into default. A lot of them, there are servicing costs. It's not. Okay. It's not free. So that you have to have a little bit of a margin.
Yep.
For that. Let me go back a little into the history, which was one of the really big victories of the Obama first administration was against a huge lobbying fight. He won back the right for the government to make these loans directly rather than having the banks do it. And the banks,
yes,
were getting billions of dollars.
Sure, they loved it.
Subsidies for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that they wanted to keep it. And in fact, they even said in their platform, the Republicans, this time around, that they would like it to become a bank program again. It shouldn't be the government. But so those billions of dollars were saved, but most of them went into health care.
Government's sort of siphoning off of this, too, for other things. It's unbelievable. What are the chances that it will go to 6.8? Is something going to stop that, do you believe, or might it actually go to...
I do believe. No one... students have always known this was a big problem for years, but it has just suddenly become recognized as a real economic problem that stops people from buying houses and stops them from getting on with their lives, and no one wants to be the one who let it go back up again at a time when rates are really historically low.
Except that's right where we stand right now, until and unless something is done. Tamar Lewin covers it for the New York Times. Tamar, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Here's Ohio Northern University College graduate Ray Ann Rocha telling CBS last April how her $48,000 in student loans are affecting her future. 28 years old, a job in public relations, she sets aside a quarter of her monthly income to pay down student loans.
The student loans delayed my wedding. The student loans will probably delay me ever buying a house with my fiancé, will probably delay my fiancé and I having children, because these are luxuries we cannot afford.
Luxuries we cannot afford, like life, because of student loans. Joining us now from New York is Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, university professor at Columbia University, former chairman under Bill Clinton of the Council of Economic Advisors, former chief economist and senior VP at the World Bank, author of The Price of Inequality, How Today's Divided Society and Endangers Our Future. His op-ed in the Times this week was Student Debt and the Crushing of the American Dream. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Joseph Stiglitz. Joe Stiglitz, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
So there's a lot you're talking about lately, but among the things you're pointing to is something Tamar was just alluding to, that student debt has now reached such a scale that it is... If I understand you correctly, you're saying it's a threat to the U.S. economy along the same lines that the overinflated housing market once was. Describe that for us, Joe.
Well, the numbers are astounding. You know, student debt now is greater than credit card debt.
It's mind-blowing.
$1.1 trillion. Big difference between credit card debt and student debt is credit card debt, you can get that down. You just stop consuming a little bit, going to the restaurant, doing a number of things that you otherwise, luxuries in life. Student debt is with you for life. Even if you get sick, even if something happens, you cannot discharge this debt in bankruptcy. So it's a real noose around your neck no matter what happens. And it was supposed to be there to give people a chance to rise in life. We now know that education is the way up, but with the student debt, education has really been – the student debt has been pulling them down. The student that you interviewed put it very forcefully. And mm-hmm. She, you know, there's data supporting exactly what she was saying. It's leading people to delay buying houses, delay having children. And in that way, it's actually holding back the economic recovery.
So it's not a threat to blow up the economy like the housing market did when it came down, but rather – what, a threat of dragging it down or keeping it from restarting properly, Joe?
That's right. Although some of the kinds of proposals that are being floated where you have a variable rate mortgage, this is going back to the blow up a few years ago, people took out variable rate mortgages, all of a sudden the interest rate soared and they were struggling. There are proposals now to make student debt work very much the same way. Low interest rate now, you borrow a lot, and then 5-10 years from now, your interest rates soar.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about student debt and the American dream with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He joins us from New York. I mean, Joe, you know these stories. I want to get to your big picture, but it's so real for so many people. And you know, here's Courtney. She writes to us on Facebook. She says, I currently have $76,000-plus in private and federal loans. I will be paying for 25 years. I'm 24 today and was told by a financial advisor I'll be living with my parents for a long time. I was told I won't be able to get married or have children, which is very upsetting. There's no way out of this. Courtney, I hope you figure out a way to do those things in spite of the debt, but that's pretty daunting. And here's another one. Joe Santamaria writes, I've just given up on vacations, children, new cars, pretty much anything that costs money. I'll spend the next 20 years or so paying off student debt. That's okay. I'll just keep paying into Social Security so old people can vote for politicians who dismantle it before I get old enough to receive those benefits. Then I'll get old and die in the gutter the way God intended. Say it ain't so, Joe, but those are two young people listening and thinking about, you know, their own profile here.
Yeah, it's a system that we've created here in the United States. It's different from that in other countries, and the underlying economics is very simple. Incomes for most Americans have been stagnating for a long time. Median family income, that is the income right in the middle, half above, half below, today is lower than it was 15 years ago. Median income, again, in the middle, yep, of a full-time male worker is today lower than it was 40 years ago. Meanwhile, with income stagnating, tuition has been soaring, particularly in the last 5 years with the recession. Totally understandable. Government cutbacks and support for education have meant that schools have to raise tuition. They have absolutely no choice. The disparity between what's happening to tuition and what's happening to income can only be met by debt in America's system. This is very different from other countries where there's a commitment to helping young people, or as in the case of Australia, very innovative idea. What they said is, yeah, students should pay for their education, but we'll develop a program called income contingent loans, where the amount that you repay depends on how much income you make. If you get, you know, if you go into banking, you make a lot of money, then you pay back more.
Why is that not happening in this country, do you think, Joe?
Well, I think it goes back to something that Tamar said. If you go back to the origins of the program, it was an enormously lucrative program for the banks. They were making literally billions and billions off of our aspiring young people. And then last year, President Obama succeeded in recapturing that money for the public purpose. Mm-hmm. But we haven't really gotten into the deeper question, how are we going to enable our young people to continue to go to college? And that's the deeper question. Australia asked that question a decade ago, found the answer, it's worked, and you know there may be other answers.
Paying in proportion to their income once they graduate, you mean?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And that way everybody, those who you know wind up being well off, pay back more. Those who go into public service, go into teaching, things like that that don't pay very well, the burden of the debt is less, but they make a significant contribution, the same percentage of their income.
Maybe the wise guys or strategists in charge of this don't believe that this upcoming generation is going to make enough to pay off these very high college costs. So they just don't believe it's there if they attach it to a percentage of income.
Well, the evidence is that investments in education do pay off, but they're very variable. Some people get a very high return. Some people don't. Some people have accidents. Some people have illnesses. There's just a lot of risk. And unfortunately, the way our system works, it doesn't take into account that risk. And so you put all the burden of risk on our young people. And the poorer the family, the more the loans they have to take out, the greater the risk. It's one of the reasons that America has become, among the advanced industrial countries, among the worst, if not the worst country, for equality of opportunity. In other words, the American dream has become a myth. And that's something that should deeply, deeply trouble us.
I mean, it's a pretty big difference. If your parents are well enough set that they can send you to school and you come out, you know, bright and clean, zero debt, and you're off into your life, that's sweet. If you come out with the average of seniors, now 26,000, and of course many it's more than that, that's a different story. That's just a different starting place in life.
Oh, very much so. And it's even worse. When I was going around the country talking about my book, The Price of Inequality, some of the most poignant stories I heard were from young people, graduated from college, did very well, but in the economic downturn, they realized that if they're going to get the kind of job that they aspire to, they needed an advanced degree, a master's degree, or they need an internship. But the good internships are unpaid. They couldn't afford that. Master's degrees require more investments in education, more debt. They couldn't afford that. And so they were stuck in debting jobs, life totally devoted to repaying the student debts.
Joe Stiglitz is with us, Nobel Prize-winning economist, and we want to get to potential solutions here, ways out of this. I mean, it is quite a knot, but we have a lot of people who want to talk with you, Joe. Mike in Des Moines, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air with Joseph Stiglitz.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. You're on.
Say, you know, I'm enjoying every bit of this conversation that you're having with the whole topic about the quality of life. And the fact of the student loans and the price to go to college is so high. My oldest son is going to Iowa City and is going to graduate next year, and he's going to be consumed with about $33,000 in debt. And that's with him doing his first 2 years at a community college here in Des Moines. You know, I have a total of four kids.
Yeah.
Two of them by a previous wife that is ex-wife that is taken me to court to get the state to make me pay for college that I can't afford, which would end up putting me into bankruptcy, which I've been trying to keep myself out of because of the recession.
And what about your son, Mike, who's coming out with $33,000 in debt? How's that stack up against what he's likely to make?
You know, he's a very intelligent individual. He's going to suffer for probably the first 10 years of his life, and for me to put food in his stomach and give him gas money to do whatever he's got to do is the most I can do. I think that the government actually has pushed this, and the state has pushed the education without any type of moral background to justify the cost of
getting it done.
College. It's crazy. I don't know how anybody's supposed to actually pay for it. You know, we had a president or a candidate come in there and say that have your parents pay for your college. He was a Republican.
Mr. Romney. Yeah.
How could he justify saying something like that when 85% of Americans can't hardly afford gasoline right now, let alone an education?
Mike, we've got it loud and clear. Of course, it's great if you got parents who can do it, but that goes to Joe Stiglitz's inequality issue. Joe, let me get one more right here. Brian in Nashville, and we'll come to you. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your story?
I'm a medical student about to graduate, so I've got loans going back to my undergraduate years, but all collectively coming up to about $110,000. about to graduate, these loans are about to come into repayment. And, you know, I've seen tuition hikes steadily over the years. You know, it's like 5% a year for the last 5 years.
$110,000 is a lot, but you're going to be a doctor, Brian. Is it manageable for you? Have you done the numbers, run them?
It's barely manageable. You know, I'm about to graduate and I'm faced with, you know, kind of entering the real world and all these expenses of just trying to make it month to month, you know, as a young resident doctor, not making kind of, you know, those larger amounts. And it is just the difficulty and seeing the numbers and the reality of it to me is just, you know, it's becoming more and more evident to me why you're seeing less of an incentive for people to try to enter into these professions, just because the, you know, the cost of the training and the difficulty of getting to where your goal is.
And you're going to come out so loaded with debt. Brian, we've got that. And one more, Lena in Florence, Massachusetts. Lena, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to make a quick comment. Mm-hmm. One part of it is that everything should not be for profit. You know, education should not be turned into a business for big banks, and we need to invest in our students and not treat them like indentured servants. And I hope that all American students can learn the news that people like my nieces in the Netherlands and in Ireland pay around $1,500 to $1,600 a semester for school, and they also get help for their books and for living expenses. Okay, so it is possible to invest in students. We have these small countries over there making sure that every kid can get into school.
Yeah, Lena, I appreciate your call. And then capping the cost of it, I mean, that looks pretty sweet to Americans. Joe, you're hearing these stories. And what about this last one? What is it about our system that makes it so expensive? If the Netherlands and Ireland can, you know, have kids going to college for $1,500 a semester, why is ours multiples of that? Is our education multiple times better than theirs?
No, it's because they provide support from the public sector because they believe that every child who has the capabilities should have access to education. It's a fundamental belief, just like they believe that everybody has a right to access to health care, that simply because you're poor shouldn't mean you should have to die if you have a disease. So these are fundamental values. America used to have the value of equality of opportunity. We said, you know, everybody who had the brain power, the determination to go to college should have the right to go to college. But we're abandoning that. And this principle of access to public education was very deep in our history. The land-grant colleges back in the 1850s, 1860s was the basis of one of the strengths of our society, of our economy. But today, we've abandoned that principle and said only if you're well enough off, if you're lucky enough to or smart enough to choose the right parents who can send you to college, do you have can you be sure that you can go on to get the higher education? And what's so sad about it is that in the 21st century, the skills that you need are the skills that you get at higher education. The disparity between those who don't graduate from college and those who do is just enormous. So we've made a collective decision, I think it's the wrong decision, not to provide the kind of support that so many of the European countries have provided.
I want to ask you about the argument that the cheaper you make the money and the more loans you make available to American students, the higher university and college costs are driven, and you get into this endless upward cycle. Richard Vedder at Ohio University famously makes this case that government's been too generous with student loans, causing college costs to rise. Here he is, Joe Stiglitz. This is Richard Vedder on Reason TV.
Government drops money out of airplanes over campuses. Those campuses use that money inefficiently. They're medievally organized. They're not disciplined by market forces. Unlike the rest of the economy, or most of the rest of the economy. And as a consequence, just like medical care, costs are rising and rising and rising.
Oh, what about that argument, Joe? If you open the
taps? I
think
it's totally wrong. You know, basically, the reasons for the increase in the cost of education are well understood. The teachers, to teach in a university, you have to have an advanced degree. And the nature of what's been happening in our economy is that those with advanced degrees have had their salaries go up at a pace that is far faster than the average. That's the whole story of the growing inequality in America. So if universities are going to attract the kind of quality that you're going to need to be able to teach the next generation, you have to pay competitive salaries. That's what's driving it. It's not any money dropping from the skies. The interesting thing is that the one part of our education system that is really, really dysfunctional are the private for-profit universities that have decided that they can prey on the least sophisticated of Americans who – these are not the universities like Harvard or Columbia. Those are non-for-profit private institutions, but they're not-for-profit. But there are a whole group of universities that have emerged in the last 10 years that are – 15 years that are for-profit and have realized that if you cut costs – provide an education that doesn't give people a job, you can still get them to take a loan out, take their money. And because of the peculiar bankruptcy law in the United States, unique again, where once you take a student loan, you cannot discharge it under almost any circumstance, they are fairly sure of getting their money back, even if they don't provide an education. It's almost like, you know, it used to be when you sold a product, satisfaction mm-hmm. guaranteed or your money back. For these for-profit schools, the answer is we almost guarantee you not to give you an education, but you'll never get your money back. Will be a noose around your neck for the rest of your life.
Our caller Florence talked about indentured servants. That sounds to pretty well describe that situation. Let's talk looking at solutions here. Let's begin to. You say on that front with private higher education providers should be on the hook for this if their students don't get jobs or can't make a decent living. What would you do?
That's right. One of the ideas I mentioned before, the Australian system of what are called income contingent loans. And where the amount that you pay depends on how well you do. Now, making some of that money that they repay linked to the education system would provide supplier incentives. In other words, if the schools that didn't train people, didn't give them education that allowed them to be a productive member of the labor force, if they were sharing that downside risk, then they would be a little bit more careful in making sure that they actually provided the education that would enable people to be productive members of the labor force.
Any sign of Congress moving in that direction to hold these institutions accountable for the income of the graduates they turn out?
Absolutely not. A little bit. But this has been an ongoing controversy. Proposals to say that if – you have a low performance rate, students don't graduate, guys that graduate don't get jobs, then you will not be eligible for government-backed student loans. You'll not be eligible for – you'll be regulated out of business. There have been a number of proposals of that kind. There have been a little progress. I don't want to say it's nothing. Very little progress, though.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about student debt and the American dream with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joe Stiglitz. His essay, Student Debt and the Crushing of the American Dream, was in the New York Times op-ed page recently. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Professor at Columbia University joins us today from New York. Should higher education be out there for everybody? The president, last July, talking from the East Room in the White House, thinks so.
Higher education cannot be a luxury reserved just for a privileged few. It's an economic necessity for every family, and every family should be able to afford it.
Okay, but they can't, and people are borrowing a whole lot. What should we do about it? Maybe there's a technology answer, Joe. Here's Bill Gates. He's been promoting technology. This is on this month, talking about how technology could change the availability of education. Bill Gates.
Technology has a lot of promise to make this a part of the economy that that we bring efficiency to, but we have incentive challenges of how to drive that forward.
So maybe we need to get incented on that front, Joe Stieglitz. What about that? Maybe we need to blow up all this high-priced education model, go to the MOOC, the massive online courses and all that, use the internet and just find a cheaper way to do it, Joe.
Well, these will be part of, you might call it the solution, but let me make it clear that good education requires teachers. No matter what happens, we will get more efficient. We will use these new technologies. We are already doing that. But even with that, our current way of financing higher education is broken. Especially so given how badly things are going for the bottom half of America and the gap that already exists between what they can afford and what an adequate education costs.
What are the economic implications if we don't fix it? What are the equality implications, both going forward?
The implication for inequality are dramatic. It will mean that there will be a growing gap between the rich and the poor. It will mean that the American dream, the notion that everybody has, that we are a country of equality of opportunity, would become even more of a myth than it is today. It means that those who are born to the top will remain at the top and those at the bottom will remain at the bottom.
Can we pause just on that for a second? What are the long-term implications of that? If it should roll that way, because we've seen inequality grow so much in this country, and yet, you know, the sort of structure of things, people have suffered plenty, but the structure of things has remained more or less the same. Life goes on kind of in a familiar way. If that keeps spinning out for more decades, where does that take us, Joe?
Well, we are becoming a more divided society, and it is having an effect. Just a couple of examples, and I think what's going on in education is one of those. You know, if you're rich, you can afford to have private transportation, private schools. Have your own, private healthcare services, all these things that you can afford because you're very wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the society then depends on public services. They can't afford education, health, transportation. But because those with the money are uninterested in those public services, the public services get worse and worse and worse.
They just don't get supported.
They don't get supported. So the gaps in our living standard get even bigger than the gaps in the numbers we suggest. And that's the direction in which we are going into a very divided society. I visited, when I was chief economist of the World Bank, I visited countries where you have those kind of divided societies. And let me say, they're not the kind of place that I would want to live in. They're not the kind of place I think most Americans would want to live in.
You mean the high walls around private lawns with glass on top and barbed wire and all that business?
Exactly. And you have to travel around with a bodyguard. There's no social fabric. We're not there yet. But it is the direction in which we're going. And it is so contrary to our basic values, of equality of opportunity. And except that, more than almost anything else, that should really be disturbing us.
Christine in Boston is calling. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been really enjoying listening to this conversation. I have a little bit of a different perspective. I just finished my doctorate degree in psychology.
Okay.
And I've been working unlicensed for about a year, so I'm not making very much. I'm 28, and I have $160,000 of student debt.
Okay.
My boyfriend is a dental student, and so when he comes out of school, he's going to have between $350,000-$400,000 himself.
Wow. Okay.
Now, yeah, so we were lucky enough to have families that could help us out with our undergrad, so we don't have a ton of undergrad loans, but the choice to go to graduate school and pursue advanced degrees to do things that we wanted to do with life has set us back financially. That was a choice we made that I understand, but what I think about and I look towards is, I'm going to be 30 when he's done with school. Mm-hmm. I want to get married. I want to have kids. I want to do all these life things that cost money themselves.
Yeah.
And we don't have families that can really support us entirely financially to do those things. So how are we supposed to have a life or live a life when we have all of this student debt? And people say to us, oh, well, you're going to have such great lives, you're going to make so much money. Yeah, when we're 60, like, what are we supposed to do before then?
So, I mean, that's about $500,000 in student debt. But you are lined up to be a psychologist and a dentist. Have you run the numbers? Does it look like it? You know, you can make it all work on that, Christine?
So we've run numbers up, down, left, and right. And it does, and especially his earning potential will be great. But the thing is, it will take him, you know, between 6 and 10 years to pay off his loans. By then I'll be 40. So it's
right.
Like, how do you balance?
Where are the kids?
Putting all the money, to get married and have kids, and I'll do those things.
Joe Stiglitz, you're the Nobel Prize economist. Can you answer this riddle?
Well, I think it is an other illustration of how our financial model is broken. We should be able to have arrangements where they can spread those costs over their longer period of time, where people who are making contributions through public service can have public support for part of their educational expenses. Other countries have found ways of doing it. I mentioned Australia's income contingent loan. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Europe, where society contributes to help support education, particularly for those who are from needy backgrounds. So there are a number of ways in which this can be done. One of the things that you were mentioning in your discussion with Tom earlier in this program mm-hmm. was the fact that the government is lending to the banks at 0.755%. and making huge profits out of the student loan. You mentioned a number, $50 billion.
Yeah.
Now, I agree with Elizabeth Warren. Something is wrong with that picture. We shouldn't be making money off of our young people who are struggling to get ahead. If we are subsidizing the banks, if we're giving them money at 0.75%, in some way or another, we ought to be making money available to our young people at comparable terms.
But we're told that we're cash strapped. I want to look at that. Will in McMinnville, Tennessee. Will, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment. I don't feel like we can totally absolve the student from responsibility here. For example, I have two young sons, and
yes.
My wife and I are saving their education down the road. And if it's enough for when they get there, great. But if not, I feel it's their responsibility to decide if they want to work with what they have or, you know, make a deal with the devil, so to speak, and borrow the money. I just feel that, you know, some responsibility will be on them. But I was just, raised that the definition that you can't afford some, you don't have the money to pay for it. So that was my comment. Enjoying your show and enjoying the panel this
morning. I appreciate your call, Will. Joe, what about it? Parents, if you don't want your kids to have the debt, save so they can go to college. And if you haven't saved enough, young person, don't go to college. Figure out another way. Be inventive.
But the fact is that to get ahead in the 21st century, you do need the education. Some people will be lucky and have parents that have foresight. But we shouldn't say to some kid, you have enormous abilities, but sorry, your parents didn't have the foresight and you can't go.
Or the cash.
Or the cash. And you can't go. So, and there are many, many Americans who might have all the foresight, but they don't have the income that would enable them to get by. Remember the level of poverty in the United States. The level of income in the middle today is the same as it was 15 years ago. So it's not like they're sitting awash at cash. They're struggling to get by. The median wealth in the United States between 2007 and 2010 went down by 40% to the levels not seen since the beginning of the 90s. So American typical families are struggling out there. They're saving as much as they can, but things are not going well. So to me, the answer is there needs to be broader support. Now, you raised an important question. Can we afford it? And I would put it the other way. I don't think we can afford not to do it. The Fed is lending money. The government is borrowing money at very low interest rates. All we're asking for is that the government use that and re-lend it to students not try to make a profit off of
these poor
students.
But that won't last forever. Interest rates will go up. They may go up very high. At that point, you're going to charge 10%, 15, 20 to those
students? Well, that's never been a part of our history.
That was my first mortgage, 17%, sir.
Yeah, well, that was an example. Mortgage market's not working right. But the average real interest rate paid by the government on its debt is between 1% and 1.5%. Now, that takes into account in periods when there's a higher inflation, the nominal interest rate may be a little higher. But the average real interest rate adjusted for inflation has been between 1% and 1.5% for a very, very long time.
So let's see if we can pass some of that on to our students. Joe, we're up against the clock here. Very grateful to you for being with us today. Nobel Prize-winning economist out of Columbia, Joseph Stiglitz. Thank you very much, Joe, for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read Joseph Stiglitz's essay, Student Debt and the Crushing of the American Dream, at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, singer-songwriter Annie Lennox addresses 2013 graduates at Berklee College of Music. This is On Point. Last Saturday, Berklee College of Music awarded honorary music doctorates to the legendary Willie Nelson, Carole King, and Annie Lennox at its commencement in Boston. British singer-songwriter Annie Lennox addressed the more than 1,000 graduates and shared how she began her music career from her years studying flute at the Royal Academy of Music in London until she dropped out to pursue another path and became one of Britain's most celebrated performers. She talked about what inspired her to become the musician she is today.
It goes back to when I just turned 14 and was surreptitiously meeting boys and going out dancing at the local dance halls, if my father would allow it, and listening to the chart hits on my small transistor radio every morning before going to school. It has to do with the Beatles, the Kinks, and the Rolling Stones, and Dusty Springfield, and Tamla Motown, and Martha Reeves dancing in the street, and Stevie Wonder's Ma Sharia Moore, and Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, and Marvin Gaye's Ooh, I bet you wonder how I do about your plans to make me blue. That's what it has to do with. Except he sang it better than that. And lower down, you know. And Diana Ross and the Supremes and Smokey Robinson and something that was happening if you were going to San Francisco, you'd have to be sure to wear some flowers in your hair, and the Beach Boys and the Mamas and Papas and psychedelia and Eastern philosophy and Procol Harum and A Whiter Shade of Pale, the first record I ever actually bought and played over and over and over and over and over again, and Traffic and A Hole in My Shoe and Round Like the Circles That You Find in the Windmills of Your Mind. While the back of my head was dissolving into Fleetwood Mac's Albatross. Oh, and Glen Campbell's Wichita Lineman. I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another. Oh, Lord, oh my God. That song. And Aretha Franklin's, the moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. And Carole King's, well, it's too late, baby, now it's too late, though we really something inside is dying, and I can't hide it, I just can't fake it. Ooh, you see where it all went? It went in here. Oh. And so much more than that, and so much more than I can ever share with you right now. The power of music in the late 60s and early 70s, remember, guys? It was like a tidal wave flooding through the medium of radio and television, saturating the heartbeats and minds of millions of teenagers in bedrooms and living rooms all across the length and breadth of the United Kingdom with a brand new popular culture. It was vivid, colourful, cool, hip, magnetic, and compelling. And I desperately wanted to be a part of it.
British singer-songwriter Annie Lennox addressing graduates of Berklee College of Music in Boston last Saturday. Here she is with the Eurythmics and Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. Check out our website for an enormous number of responses to our conversation today on student loans. You may find yourself reflected in those comments. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.